Until 11, Mitchell's Front Page on 94.7 The Pulse.
And with me on the line now is Anita Talberg, a PhD student in the Australian-German Climate and Energy College at the University of Melbourne. Anita, good morning.
Good morning, Mitchell.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning, and I've just read your piece in The Conversation, which says, as we know, that Labor has come out with some more ambitious reductions targets to emissions. They've said 45% based on 2005 levels, but you're saying, or the science is saying, that even more cuts are needed.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say that the science is saying it. We can say that what we know is that globally we need to do more. And what you think Australia needs to do is actually a question of values and what you think would be a fair distribution of emissions reductions between different countries.
That is true. I mean, when you look at the emissions reduction targets that are being set, it's confusing on one sense because some targets are using 2000 levels, some of them are using 2005 levels. Why would there be that difference?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in a way, you can see that a little bit as sort of fiddling the numbers and trying to make things look a little bit better. So it's just the same as me saying to you, for example, I'm going to lose 10 kilos, but I'm not going to tell you from which weight I'm going to lose it from. Or I'll say I'm going to lose 10 kilos based off my weight yesterday as opposed to 10 years ago. It's going to completely change how much you actually do when you announce what year you're going to do that off. So up until recently, most countries were announcing that they would reduce their emissions based off 2000 levels. That was the standard across all countries. And then we started seeing different baselines coming in. So the US, for example, announced it off 2005. And you can actually look at Australia's target is very much matched to the US target. So it's almost as though we're trying to make our target look a little bit better by changing that baseline. In effect, it makes about 2 or 3, up to 4% difference for Australia.
So essentially, the emissions in 2005 were higher than 2000. So if you reduce your emissions on 2005 levels, it looks like you're doing more.
That's exactly right.
Now, with the whole situation between the different political parties, on one hand, you've got the government saying that our emissions target reductions, I think it's about 25% based on 2005 levels. They're saying that that's among the highest in the OECD. But on the other hand, you've got the Labour Party and the Greens almost saying, well, this is an international laughingstock. I mean, they can't both be right, can they?
No, that's right. Well, actually, they can all be right, and that's the difficulty in this whole game, is that it depends on how you what you're talking about and what you think is fair. So certainly, what the government is saying with their 26 to 28% on 2000 levels by 2030, and they're justifying that by saying that it's economically responsible, and it's certainly, I guess, been talked about, I guess, as being in line with something that we could achieve. What matters then is whether you decide what's important. So Australia has one of the highest per capita emissions. So that means the amount of emissions that each person in Australia emits compared to, say, for example, each person in India or even in Europe or the US. So the sense is that, well, we actually kind of need to do a little bit more to bring that down to be fair across, I guess, globally. So what the Climate Change Authority did, so the Climate Change Authority is an independent body assigned by the government that looks into these sorts of issues. And what they've said is that based on cost effectiveness, environmental effectiveness and equity, which is one of the issues that needs to come into this game, Australia needs to do, and they've said 40 to 60% on 2000 levels, which translates to about 44% to 63% on 2005 levels. So what Labor is announcing is actually on the lower end of what the Climate Change Authority has recommended, and what the Greens are proposing is on the upper end of what the Climate Change Authority has recommended.
But at the same time, I mean, that could be a very costly process, and obviously this is where the debate comes in, and that's why the government, I suppose, is saying that this is more economically responsible, because if you do cut emissions quite dramatically, that's going to move things very quickly through the economy and I suppose create a bit of uncertainty, and some may say, well, that's what you have to do if that's where the world's going, but some may say, well, is the risk worth it?
Well, cost is an interesting one to bring in, because what the science is actually very clear on is that the longer you delay, the more costly it becomes. So if we agree that we need to keep greenhouse gas emissions to a certain level to have a 67, and this is what the science is saying, 67% chance of staying below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, then we know we need to reach zero emissions at some stage, and the trajectory is quite clear. Obviously, there's some uncertainty in the science. We can't predict everything, but we've got a pretty good idea of where we need to be, and the longer we delay, the more costly that effort becomes. So it depends on how much you value what a dollar spent today versus a dollar spent in 2020 or in 2030.
And why does the price increase? Because as I said earlier, I would have thought the price would almost stay the same or go down, just because if you look at where renewable energy has been, say, 10 years ago versus today, it's much cheaper today. So what costs cause it to increase?
Well, there are several factors involved, and just completely ignoring the cost of inaction. So the actual cost of needing to pay for the damage that we are going to be getting from climate change, so extreme weather events, health bills, our infrastructure that we need to update. So these are all the costs of not doing anything as unavoidable climate change keeps occurring. So ignoring that completely is just a simple case of, obviously you have an argument there that as the technology improves, it is more cost effective, or it's cheaper, for example, to roll out, say, solar panels or whatever the technology might be. And that's definitely something to take into consideration. But what's actually difficult is trying to reduce emissions very quickly. If we do it gradually, it's a tweak here and there. We increase our energy efficiency. We change practices here and there. And we build buildings, for example, that don't consume as much energy. We build cars that don't consume as much fuel. And slowly you transition to a low-carbon economy. If suddenly you need to make those changes, then you're talking about retrofitting buildings or shutting down power plants that we probably shouldn't have built in the first place. So can you see how if you do it gradually, you're actually minimizing the costs?
Well, I can definitely see when you put it like that, that if you do it gradually, but at the same time, I mean, 40 to 60% does sound like it could be quite a steep cut. I'm just saying, as a layperson, I mean, obviously you're the expert.
Yeah, I mean, and your point is completely valid, and that's where the discussion is going in Paris at the moment. The conference started yesterday, so Monday,
yeah.
And this is where the discussion is. I mean, what is a fair? How much should we be cutting, given that we've taken advantage of fossil fuel emissions up until now, and as to develop and to get to where we are today? And there's no right answer to what. You know, to this question, but I guess one of the points that will be made by the developing countries is that we have the capacity to do so. We have the financial resources and we can make those changes. The potentially poorer countries that are still trying to electrify, still trying to get clean water, still trying to feed half their population may not have that capacity to do. So if you put it that way, it's 40 to 60% actually doesn't look like that much at all.
And when we look at these Paris climate talks, I mean, there's been some difficulty over the years when it comes to trying to get an agreement internationally. Do you think that the Paris climate talks are going to be more positive?
I think they will be. What happened in Copenhagen, so I was at the climate talks in Copenhagen, and they've been heralded as somewhat of a failure. And I don't know that that was necessarily, necessarily fair. It's quite difficult to get 195 countries to one table to talk about an issue that affects us all and that is quite difficult to resolve. So in that sense, Copenhagen was a chance for these developing countries to actually stand up and say, we actually need to have a voice in this as well. And so while it was hailed as a failure, there were some little signs of success in there. What Paris is doing is, rather than trying to put an agreement that was formed sort of by a few people and enforce that onto the rest of the world, it's everybody coming together and trying to discuss what is plausible, what can we start with, what's a good starting point, and then how do we make that stronger as time goes by. So I think whatever comes out of Paris, it will be seen as a success. What is more important is what happens after Paris, is what mechanisms are put in place to make sure that this starting point is only a starting point, and that every 5 years we increase that ambition and reach the target that we need to reach ultimately.
And we hear a lot of commentators saying that this could be the last opportunity to take action and we need to reduce our emissions now and very quickly. When you look at it from that perspective, do you think that people are more motivated at Paris to take action than perhaps what they have been at previous conferences and meetings?
I really wouldn't know how to comment on that, just because the urgency has been there for a long time. And what happens in these talks is really an interesting and complex combination of so many different factors. People often compare the climate talks to what happened with the talks in the 80s on the ozone layer, when we discovered there was a hole in the ozone layer, and that was happening from things like refrigerants and our aerosol cans and things like that. And all of a sudden, all the governments were motivated and we took action. It was really, really effective. Now, there's been a lot of commentary on what was the factor there that made the difference? How come we received such effective action on the ozone treaty, and yet it's proving so difficult with climate change. And, I mean, there's no way to really know. Certainly there's some political will, whether that's enough. What is the extra ingredient that's needed to make sure that this treaty becomes successful? I don't know.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate all of those insights, and it's a conversation I think that we're going to have for a very long time.
Great. It was nice to talk to you, Mitchell.
Thank you very much, Anita Talberg there, PhD student in the Australian-German Climate and Energy College at the University of Melbourne. And her article in The Conversation was titled, Labor Pledges 45% Emissions Cuts by 2030, but the science says more is needed. And I suppose it's not always about how much, this is what we were sort of saying yesterday, I'm not sure it's about how much you actually end up cutting, but more about how you do it. And that's where the conversation needs to go, I would think, because it's all well and good to say we want to cut our emissions targets by 60%, but how exactly will you go about doing that? That sounds like it could be a very difficult process. But anyway, we'll continue to observe this Paris situation, and I'll be interested to see if it actually results in anything more fruitful than perhaps we've seen over previous years. But we'll go to a track of music now on Mitchell's Front Page. Coming up next, we'll be joined by Elaine Carbines, the CEO of the G21. She's in the process of flying to Canberra, and we'll talk to her about the latest news from the G21 region.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.